I appreciate the theme of this camp. It has to do with really exploring our interconnection with each other, celebrating the perfections that come through each soul. So many beings, so many paths, or as Jesus said, so many beings, so many gods. You know, I mean, because God is hidden within every being, and each one in their own way displays those perfections, even if they are in a negative relationship with those perfections. The wounded person whose love has been twisted into hate is expressing love, if you could see deep enough into their heart. I want to speak to the question of what is the path of initiation and discipleship, because Arifa was speaking at our staff meeting this morning about there were all these initiators lunches yesterday, and then there was a table of people that were inquiring about what this all means, and I'd like to just speak to it because it has to do with a different kind of connectivity. This is we're trying to build this sense of the Sangha, of a community that respects each other and supports each other in their process. And at the same time, we are the inheritors of a tradition of men and women who, as Hazrat Khan said, could rightly have been considered the spiritual emperors of the world. We carry this blessing with us. That's called a lineage. That's called sometimes the chain of illuminated souls. But the idea of a chain is cold and steely. But if you can imagine a chain of hearts, a stream of beings that are united in their flowing together, where all of the qualities that have been realized are shared freely in that stream and are flowing, as long as we can open ourselves to our connection with it. And so at the most simple way of putting it, initiation is joining that stream in a way in which you affirm your openness to receive these blessings and to be a part of that stream of blessing. The teacher is only as good as their effacement in that stream of blessing. And the teacher's strength comes from that effacement. And the people like myself that have had a role of being a teacher for more than 40 years know that we could never have stood alone here and done this work without burning out and becoming totally alienated and discouraged and in our ego if we didn't feel our merchant, our teacher is with us, and her teacher is with us. And all the way through all the illuminated souls, Moinuddin Chishti said, everyone who's ever initiated in relationship to me, as we all are, and all the Inayati orders, has my blessing, has my heart, has my... You know, the teacher's practice is oneness. Not I'm something and you're nothing. It's not that at all. It's understanding a place of merging with the oneness of that soul in such a way that whatever you have in your atmosphere, in your stream, is freely shared with them. They can draw on it to the extent that they are open to it. As Husserl Nikon says, if they give you a finger, the teacher will say, that's sufficient. But if you give you a hand, he will say, that's sufficient. If you give you but you can really never give enough, you know, because the gratitude is so great, not to that particular ego, but to that person who has stood there in trust, holding their unity with the stream of blessing that passes through from eternity, through these realized souls articulated within a lineage stream which has particular qualities. Each stream has different qualities. Each path, if you choose to be the Sufi path, you'll probably get more hugs than if, for example, than if you choose to be on the path of Zen Buddhism, you know, where but the paths are such that they appeal to different souls, and they appeal because it's not about one path or one way is superior to another. It's about what will be the key to the opening of your heart. What will be the key to the illumination of your soul, so that you can bring forth what you are here to do. Everyone is born. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, precious human birth. You know, wake up every day grateful that I'm alive. I'm a human being. I have this precious human birth. What a great opportunity it is to have this precious human birth. We could do that because here we have a vehicle in the human body that has proven through the test of time that it can be a sufficient vehicle for full realization. And so, to have that opportunity to be here and to grow and to learn within the different you know, it's all like a tree. You see, if you look at these lineage trees, they all relate to each other. I mean, within a different context. Sufism became defined as Sufism after the time of the Prophet Muhammad, when the Sufi orders began to be formed. But before that, as Husserl Nikon says, you know, that this is... it has no beginning, really, because Sufism is really gnosis. It's really knowing your real self is God. Tatvamasi, thou art that. Atman is Brahman. The real essence of self is nothing but God, if we knew it. So we're unaware of it, and we need vehicles of awakening to it. And the problem is, it's very hard to lift yourself by your own bootstraps. You know, I mean, I've just never been able to do it. maybe a different, you know, different bootstraps if they were longer. You know, and that's why, you know, by being open to another being, you know, in the sense of accepting them, that you don't have to look at an initiator as someone who is a fully enlightened being who has all the answers. That none of us do have all the answers, but the answers flow. Merchant Sam said, Husserl Nikon said, I learn more from my disciples than they learn from me. And I think every real teacher, you know, if they're going to be a teacher, has to continue to be a better student. Jesus said when they were arguing, he heard his disciples arguing about who would be the greatest after he left. He said he got down and he washed their feet. And he said, let he who would be the master be the servant of the rest. So it's... you know, the people that see, the ego wants to sit in the chair of power, and that's the one thing that we don't want to let sit in the chair. We don't want to let the ego or the superego sit in the chair of the arsh throne, of the heart throne of the divine being. And so people think, oh, well, you know, I can't accept a teacher because I'm afraid I'll lose my freedom. But actually, we lose our freedom by surrendering to our ego, by surrendering to just the nafs, where we can't overcome the impulse, and we think that we have to be the one that is teaching, so that to set aside that spirit of argumentation, to set aside the mental cogitation about it, and to have a place where you can look at someone, you say, okay, I trust them, you know, I mean, they can be the most ordinary person in the world. Hazre Nikon, but as long as they're standing in that stream with integrity, with self-surrender, with knowing that it's not their ego that's doing it. It is, you know, they are, yeah, their will and their particular individuation and their particular qualities that are most awakened are the vehicles through which they work, but their heart is in that place where you can trust, and you can trust them to stand with you, and therefore you can draw from that trust, from that place, all much greater wisdom than the teacher. Much, you know, if students didn't ever surpass the teachers, then the direction of spiritual, of everything would be just always down. And teachers have to understand this. You know, most of my work now is working with the teachers in our order. I'm not taking new Murids. I take Murids that have been around for a while, and they shift within an order, a particular teacher. I try and help people in that way. Merchant Sam said that, and you'll appreciate this because the tone of the this camp is in this vein. He said, in the same vein where Hazre Nikon was saying, I learn more from my disciples than they learn from me. He said, I feel like a mother when the murid comes to me with a true need, my breasts give milk to them. It's not, it's something that's drawn forth from me. It's not something that I have. It is something that's drawn forth from me, from the source that I continue to try and surrender to be one with, from this whole line of teachers that we need to respect. And Nikon says, the democracy of the ego and the aristocracy of the soul, which is to say, we need to give respect to beings that to know that there are beings that we can learn from, that there are, and that one of the ways to learn is to set aside just our sense of that we are. I don't want to give up my own freedom. Well, an icon says the Sufi message is a message of spiritual liberty. It's to overcome all of the limitations that our concepts have put on us, that our religious training or enculturation has put on us, so that we can know that the soul is truly free in its expression. But to get to that place where we are moving from our own genuine, real self freely it's so easy for a person to become intoxicated in their sense of ego, and to and their ego appropriates it, and they say, "Oh yeah, everybody says I'm great. I must be really terrific." You know, I mean, my poo doesn't stink. You know, I mean, you know what I'm saying? You know, they take license, and so a real student can gain from a false teacher. From a teacher, from an incomplete teacher, from a teacher that gets caught up in their ego too, because they are, as an icon says, it's in the seeking that we find. The earth, if you dig deeply enough in the earth, you will find water. So you can. So if you are sitting in that role and you think, well, I don't know if I'm worthy to do this, though they did recognize me, and you know, each order. You take refuge in that thought. You know that it is. It's not me, and I can set that aside, and. You know, in Buddhism, we say guru yoga, you know. I mean, but all the teachings, are, you know, my path, that was what led to my overcoming my confusion in life, was to be led to a real teacher, a teacher that, who was Merchant Samuel Lewis. And my path of realization was a path of merging of heart, you know, because the teacher would like nothing better than to enlighten everybody, you know. But nobody has that ability to just enlighten everybody. You can be around the most enlightened person and be like a stone. And you can be around the most unenlightened person, but if your vision is open, like, say, a Papa Ram Dass, you're seeing Ram action behind that person. And so, but there is a real importance in our time. You see, in our time, you know, the thing is, nobody's any better than me. It's a challenge. That's what our ego says. Nobody's any better than me. I got to stand my own. I got to stand my ground. And what the spiritual path says is, you're nothing. God is everything. You know, and that reminds me of a great story, a joke, you know, because I'm being very serious. And then I used to tell this joke for years, and then I heard Robin Williams tell it on but it's set in a synagogue in Europe and some years ago, and it's the High Holy Days, and it's the Day of Atonement, and the rabbi, he gets inspired in the standing before the congregation, and he says, "Oh God, thou art everything, and I am nothing." And everyone in the congregation, in appreciation. You know. And then the cantor, who's the rabbi who sings the service, he gets inspired and he says, "Oh God, thou art everything, and I am nothing." And everybody says, And then Schmierli, the tailor who's sitting in the back of the room, he gets inspired. And he stands up and he says, "Oh God, thou art everything, and I am nothing." And the rabbi turns to the cantor and says, "Look who thinks he's nothing." You know, we get hung up even on our ideas of being nothing, you see. And so the only, you know, it's kind of like an icon says in his text on the path of initiation and discipleship. Yeah, he says it's possible to swim from England to Europe, but you'll do better if you book passage on. You have a more secure chance of getting there if you book passage. And in the history of the world, most of the people who have fully awakened have taken a real spiritual path and made a commitment to it. Taking initiation is called taking hand, making a pledge. And what is the pledge that a person makes? It is the pledge, that I will accept you as a spiritual guide, that I will give my allegiance to this message that you represent here, this, in our case, the Sufi message, articulated for the West by Pir Murshid Hazrat Inayat Khan, but linked with this great chain of Sufis, Moinuddin Chishti, all the way back to Hazrat Ali and Prophet Muhammad, you know, and you can feel, you can feel this a blessing, and that's the blessing when you give an initiation. You're initiated in the name of all of these beings. You're calling them forward to be present and to be available to you, according to a kind of inner grace, and within a different. Orders, you know, the different orders of Sufis, just like there are different sects of Buddhism or Christianity, but the difference is really more, much closer to like the different. They're more a different fragrance than they are a difference in meaning or depth. In other words, one. According to the sort of the defining practice of the peer, of the founding peer of that order, there's a certain tone that is set, that a quality that is accentuated within that stream. So certainly in the stream of Sufi Ahmed Murad Chishti, Murshid Samuel Lewis, there is this baraka of tremendous presence in activity, in movement, he said, you know, his view was that the West, Westerners were active people, and they needed an active practice, and so that's why he accentuated the dances and walks as a vehicle for awakening and the experience of joy. As a vehicle for opening people's hearts and love, you know. So if you awaken a person's joy and love, then you will awaken their whole being and their courage to face life in a real way. So people say, Arifa was saying, well, some people wanted to know what's the difference between the Sufi order and the Sufi movement and the Sufi Ruhaniyat, and not much, because we all have the core teachings of Hazrat Inayat Khan behind us. This body of teachings which he has distilled from the great legacy of the Sufis. He didn't invent Chagall or Kassab. He didn't invent the various practices that are given. He didn't make it all up. What he did do was say, okay, in our time, we need to find how this essence of this message can be described in a way that people in the West can hear it, not a way in which you have to become a Muslim or you have to believe this or that in order to do this. So he opened it up in this way for us. But there are consequences in turn, and I'm just trying to talk very practically here to people because there are people here that may don't know. There are consequences of choosing a different lineage, that even though they are all traced back to Hazrat Inayat Khan, because there are practices that are preferred. For example, the Naqshbandi lineage is. They don't do standing zikrs, you know. They only do sitting zikrs. Okay, they do breath practice and concentration practice and so forth. Some other lineage requires you to first show that you are a good practitioner of the religion, and then to get to the heart of it. We found in our time, when the Sufi message was revived in America by Hazrat Samuel Lewis and Hazrat Vilayat Khan, you know, I mean, because it was practically gone here in America by that time in the late 60s. They had to find a way to speak to the fact. Well, you see, Murshid said he was flat out. He'd never been able to gather any students. His work was on the inside, really, and on the outside, trying to bring seeds to different countries to grow. Fitting seeds to soils. You know, working. You know, bringing understanding between different people in religion and who were teaching in the universities and so on, the different religions and making them so separate and so discreet and so on. But he was flat on his back in the hospital in 1966, I think it was, or 67. And he said, God appeared to me and said, I make you the spiritual leader of the hippies. And the reason was, a lot of us hippies were having tremendous experiences, but we had no guidance. We had no ground. We had no paradigm. We had no sense of how you move with it. You know, we just there's a kind of an inspiration that comes directly from the source. It's called mulhim. And then the qualities of guidance. Mulhim is when you know it's unstructured, direct, no intermediary. You're just you're receiving it. But that was the condition we were led in. And the thing is, you know, people in that state can't tell the difference between hearing voices that are telling them to drop their children off the bridge and hearing voices that are telling them to, you know, something very wise, because their ego thoughts and everything is getting mixed up in this inspiration that is coming to them. And they need, you know, I mean, and he, what he did was, you know, he didn't reject us. He let us know that our experiences were valid, but we needed to find that there was a basis of validity within our experience, but that we needed to have a path and we needed to have a grounding in order to benefit from it. And so that's what a guide can do for you. And you know, for me, I mean, I just like to say that, and it. In his, oh, I was going to tell this story before. Anayat Khan tells it in his text on the path of initiation and discipleship, but also I recommend Murshid Samuel Lewis's commentary on it and on the inner life, because it draws it out more for Westerners to understand what's behind Hazrat Anayat Khan's teaching. But he says this. He says there was a great Sufi sheikh in Delhi or somewhere, and he had a son who was with him, and everyone assumed that his son would pass something on to. But when it came time for him, he said to his son, "I want you to go take a bayat from this disciple of mine, this farmer out in the country." Very simple man. Not someone who's going to be talking about the metaphysics of Ibn Arabi, for example, or knowing a lot of profound practices. Just someone of a simple being of heart who knew God's presence, right? And he obeyed him, and he went out in his fine clothes to find this man, and he walked into the country, and there he was plowing a field, sitting on his horse, a very muddy place, sitting with the horse and the plow, and he's moving along, and he sees this young man in the distance, and realizes in an instant what his teacher had in mind, and The man is, he doesn't want to get his nice shoes dirty, you know, and he's kind of walking like this. And then the man on the horse, he says, "You need to bow." And so he bows, and he says, "No, bow." And he bows some more. He says, "No, bow." And then he finally gives it all up, and he gets down in the mud, and he bows, and he says, "Very good, now you can return to your father and receive instructions." we have to give up our allegiance to our own egoicity in order to enter the path. Which is not to say you give up your ego, because, you know, if we could, we could just put it on the table, you know, and say, "Okay, now, you know, let's go have dinner." It doesn't, you know, but we give up our allegiance to it because it enslaves us into a kind of a blindness where we don't know how to proceed. So to be truly free and to have liberty, we need to have the ability to rise above the impulse, any given impulse, and transcend it and not go with it, as well as to know that any impulse in its root is sacred, and if we can find that sacredness in the root of that impulse, we find the tent peg of all desire, and we come from that place, and its expression is divine. So both of these things are true, that the self-expression, when it comes from this place of finding the root of where the impulse is coming from, and knowing that's divine and being a vehicle of that divine expression is spiritual liberty. And but you can't really know that you are free until you know that you can rise above an impulse. If you can rise above an impulse and not go with it and just look at it and notice it, and it rises and it falls, and you then you're free to go with it. But if you're a slave to it and you can't prevent yourself from whatever it is, you know, that is pulling you forward, even if you wanted to, and you don't really want to, but there's some that, then you're not free, even though you say, "Well, I'm just doing whatever I want, so I'm free." You see, so within the surrender is freedom, and within the assertion of ego is slavery. And so a lot of things are like that. They're not exactly, there's a paradox involved here. Koans are always emphasizing that, and because my teacher came from Rinzai Zen tradition as well as the Sufi tradition, he had to decide. You know, when people, you know, when Moinuddin, Pir Moinuddin, when Moore should say, when he met him, he saw the Sufi symbol emblazoned on his forehead. You know, and he, how many people here knew Moinuddin? Still a number of people. How many people here knew Merchant Sam when he was alive? Yeah, okay. There were three of us here. Yeah. Okay. And pretty soon, you know, you go to an assembly, there won't be anybody, you know. I mean, but Moinuddin and Fatima got led there, Carl and Pat got led there when... they were out in the Haight-Ashbury, and Janet Planet, who was the brown-eyed girl in Van Morrison's song, the brown-eyed girl, you know, she was sometime intimate of him, and she said, "I know there's this Zen master." You know, so they were led to Sam to meet the Zen teacher, but he had to decide whether he was going to use his entitlement, his empowerment as a as a Zen teacher or as a Sufi teacher to when people started coming to his door. When we started, I was literally led to him on an LSD trip, you know. My steps were guided right to him. Everybody's heard that story. But all I'm saying is that why did he choose Sufism rather than Zen? Because he wanted to make, he didn't know how long he was going to be here. He wanted to make sure that at least we loved one another. And then he said, well, you know, his playful way of saying it was, well, he says, I've been involved in Buddhist organizations and Sufi organizations my whole life, and they're all full of ego. He says, but he says, at least the Sufis don't say there's no such thing as the ego. But you know, say, you know, the different stages of it, and at the Mercy said, even Jesus Christ had an ego because something had to hold it all together for him to function. But when he, but not much of one, because when he died, it slopped all over everything. You know, I just wanted to say this, you know, because for me, the path of initiation and discipleship was the key path for me in life, you know, the merging with the teacher such that I could feel that I wasn't separate from his realization. Why? Because he didn't set up a separation. If you went into it, if you... You found that openness was there. So the path of initiation is just making that openness to enter into a relationship with this tremendous history of enlightenment and blessing that has been passed down through the ages. Doesn't mean giving. And in fact, Mercy said, sometimes you learn from your teacher not to make the same mistakes that they make. You know, when we talk about young adults and where they are, I mean, we were all young. I mean, God, when Merchant Sam died, Moindy and I were sort of the eldest teachers, so to speak, in the community. And he was 29, I was 28. You know, I mean, And you talk about elders, I mean, I can't quite relate, you know, because, you know, well, I mean, anybody that's crazy enough to have a child when they're 60 years old, you know, like me, but Mercy used to say, you know, they're old souls and young bodies here, and they're young souls and old bodies around here, you know. The soul is ageless, so what he meant was people come in with more development sometimes than others, more advanced souls. Right now, a lot of advanced souls are being born on Earth. Why? Because they took a bodhisattvic oath of some sort. And they want to show up when times are difficult. And this is what they signed up for, to be here, to address, you know, suffering, you know, no matter, you know, how innumerable sentient beings are. I vow to liberate them all, no matter how countless the passions are. I vow to extinguish them all, no matter how... boundless the pathways of the Dharma are. I vow to traverse them all, you know, no matter how unimaginable the realization of the Buddha is, I vow to attain to it. But this is what a bodhisattva says in some form or other, and Merchant Sam says, by making space, you know, whether you make that particular verbal affirmation or not, you make space for God to work through you. You make space for reality to work through you. In the same way, the link of initiation, you make space for this whole stream of blessing to work through you. And so that's the advantage of the path, of taking a hand with someone that stands in, you know, in an authentic way in that stream of blessing. It doesn't matter if they're the farmer in the field, you know, or some brilliant metaphysician that can charm you, you know. And as Senzaki said, he has this beautiful book, if anybody's interested in probing some of the conundrums of Zen. It was a lovely edited book called Eloquent Silence. And he goes into the discussion of the different koans, you know, the pathless path, the flute without a mouthpiece. These are the books of koans, you know. You start out with a paradox, right? The pathless path, right? The solid iron flute without a mouthpiece, you know. But he said, you know, please don't take this for my Zen. You know, he says, I feel embarrassed by it. But somebody, it's a dirty job, but somebody has to do it, you know. Because all these things have been out there, you know, about, and people have such confused ideas about it. So at least at the level of ideas, this has to be addressed. Yeah. And a few years ago, Abraham and Halima, who some of you know, merchants at Cambridge in the Boston area, and students of Mercer Sam, psychologists, and they were at a meeting with His Holiness the Dalai Lama at Harvard at the Psychology East and West symposium that was there. And Psychology East and West. You know, I mean, they're looking to see, just like any, like the Sufis are, what's the psychological way to break through? Anayat Khan came over here and, you know, he couldn't use all the methodology that he'd used. You know, people didn't understand surrender to the teacher. They didn't understand, you know, learning by presence and not by words. He used to tell the story that, you know, when he went to study with his teacher, Abu Hashim Madani, you know, he didn't talk about anything spiritual, you know, at all, you know, this and that. And, you know, but he would be with him because of his presence, you know. And then one day he began to talk in these kind of philosophical terms, and Hazrat Anayat Khan started to write it down, and he stopped. You know, but Senzaki was able to make the bridge between East and West psychology, one of the first, and we were very fortunate because the first Buddhist teacher to come to America was Shaku Soyan, who came at the same time as Vivekananda. I think it was 1896, or maybe it was 1893 in Chicago at the World's Exposition and Fair, and they brought in all these world teachers, but. You know, they were always universal. He said, in lectures of sermons of a Buddhist abbot, he says, Mary and Kuan Yin, they are the same person. They are the same being. You know, trying to overcome, we want to own. This is my Allah. You take another name. This will be your Jehovah over here, and this will be your, you know, God over here. And, you know, if God is one, God is one, God is one. That's a unity. That's not a you know, I'm one and you're one. That's a different kind of one. This is a one that is a unity. And so we learn by merging, and to merge, we have to give up our own sense where we have to always be in charge of it, and our mind has got to be in control of it. And so that's just this taking the step. I'll hold these teachings as a sacred and secret trust. Why secret? Why not talk about them? Why? Because, you know, because your experiences, you need to let grow deeply within you. It's not because, you know, this is something special for you, you know, that I've got because I'm a member of this club. That's not it. It's because when you start talking about your experiences and you know, you spend them instead of building them up within the altar of the heart in a way and letting them grow. It's like taking a little tiny plant that hasn't established roots and saying, look at this plant, you know, and then pretty soon it's dead over here, you know. But I think a lot of people don't say that anymore, and because, you know, the times change. You know, the teachings that are now available at a drugstore and everything is online, the most esoteric practices, years ago, you couldn't get for money for anything, nothing. They weren't available because people wanted to reserve them for those that were ripe to receive them. And that's but as Jesus said, the Pharisees, who were the rabbis, the chief rabbis at the time, they have the keys to the kingdom, but they don't use it themselves, and they don't offer it to others. And Mercy said to me, "Don't block the doorway." So at a certain point, the spirit of guidance, the cosmic mind that is the accumulator of all the wisdom of all time that is moving through history with us, decided, open the doors. Less harm will be done to people by abusing these practices than is done by concealing and withholding them. More harm's done by withholding them than by making them open. And so, like, for example, this book that we published, The Physicians of the Heart, is really a handbook for teachers, you know, in one sense. But we, in other days, it would have been given to someone when they were empowered as a teacher in a particular, and said, okay, now, like, you're given permission. Hazrat Nakhon was given permission by Abu Hashim Madani to teach, you know. And so then, okay, and here are some of the treasures of our lineage. You can use this for your work. Today we just publish it, you know. It's out there. Anybody can use it. Try to make it so that, you know, it's good to have an actual physician of the heart that you're working with, someone that can see and reflect you back. Because what you're doing when you're working with someone is you're reflecting their perfections back at them. Because you're not practicing a separation. You're looking into their soul, and you're holding forward in your atmosphere what it is that they are, what's incipient in them, what's what they need, and what's growing in them, for example. Well, I've talked a long time. When I start talking like this, I forget the time, and actually we've come to the end. I wanted to allow questions, but I will have questions tomorrow in class. And I just wanted to speak to this subject. I haven't in any means covered it, but I do feel like I have given you a sense that I really respect, why I respect this tradition of taking initiation. And I'm grateful for that opportunity because I know many people here have this. This is their path, and maybe I'm kind of putting some of what you feel into words, too. So let's do a practice. First, we'll do this one. I like to do this practice from Joe Miller. It goes like this. Om Ma Hung, and then a big ha. Here we go. Om Ma. Thank you. God bless you.